Treacheries of the Space Marines. The Master's Bidding by Matthew Farrar. In the days between the third and final War Ungskar and the wars that the Imperium was to name the Grey Blood Tribulations, Chengral of the Iron Warriors greeted four visitors in his fortress home among the wrecked worlds of the Mitre Gulf. It was an outlandish procession that came from the landing craft which had touched down at his outer walls. Chengral watched it with surly suspicion, for all he had invited these visitors himself. The paths were lit up with the riotous clamour of the Emperor's children, and the more regal but equally dazzling livery of the Thousand Sons. The Night Lords cloaked their armour and kept their silence, but the word-bearers hoisted their banners proudly and lifted their voices in discordant songs of worship. Chengral glowered at them all as they converged on the meeting square he had built, exchanging taunts and boasts. They had landed in a great ring of fortifications that Chengral had erected on the world he had claimed, in a place designed to flaunt his power. In a half-circle around the eastern walls, he had built stone ziggurats capped with platforms for the landers, and broad fields in which his visitors could see their pavilions. In the centre of the ring were the ruins of an old imperial settlement, and in these ruins was the meeting square, beneath a canopy of wiry and blighted trees, just large enough for Chengral to confer with only his most distinguished guests. There was a surrounding wall and an arch for his guests to file through, and a stone platform upon which Chengral himself could stand and address them. Chengral had made his own home out of a crashed orcish raider ship, which had ploughed into the world's surface during the fiercest fighting of the war years before. He had hollowed out the great mound of the hull, sunk pits into the rock beneath it, and filled the space with barracks, forges, and batteries. The ramming prow was rebuilt into a high-crowned gate and a processional, down which Chengral could lead his warriors when he wished to hunt, or to go forth to war. It was when Chengral first picked over the wreck of this ship that he had found an unusual prize. In a net of fine diamond fibre were a full dozen stones, fist-sized, gently curved almost like eggs, impossibly hard, so smooth they were almost slick to the touch, and such a deep and lustrous red that they almost seemed to burn. Chengral knew full well what he had found, although not how they had come to be there. Had the Eldar really allowed so many soul stones to fall into the hands of the orcs? Or had the stones already been torn from their dead owners, baubles that caught a greenskin's eye when their original collector had become a trophy in their own turn? No matter. Although Chengral himself had little direct use for the stones, he knew many others valued them as precious indeed, and so he sent out his heralds. For four responses, that gnawed at his pride. Certainly Chengral had not expected every one of his summons to be answered. Some of his heralds had been unable to find their recipients amongst the churn of the Eye of Terror or along the perpetual trails of war that the traitor legions blazed. Others had returned with rebuffs, and some had not returned at all. But still, no more than four? Was there some plot afoot among the other legions to defame him and isolate him? What enemies were moving against him? So thinking, he went down from his fortress to greet his guests. Master Chengral was an iron warrior of old, who had earned his scars and his honours at the walls of the Imperial Palace during the last fearful days of the Horus Heresy. Millennia of fighting in the Long War had taken its toll on his body, stripping the flesh and then breaking the steel which replaced it. Now Chengral's remains floated in a thick flesh syrup within a great four-legged dreadnought built to his own personal design. His face, miraculously untouched by war, but bloated and puffy like a baby's, peered out at the world through a hemisphere of armoured glass built onto the hulk's front, with eyes that writhed as though their sockets were packed with maggots. What those eyes now saw was the four emissaries striding into the square, each seeking to outdo the others in the arrogance and power of their bearing. Chengral had set out a half circle of iron chairs for his guests, adorned with suddenly glowing gems and angular scrollwork, and now each wordlessly paid their respects to their host and took their seats. On the far left sat Hoda of the Night Lords, dressed in worn and pitted battle armour, over which he had thrown a cloak of shining black feathers. Every so often, luminous blue-white trails would crawl and sizzle from the cloak and worm their way over the surfaces of his warplate. At each hip was a braided leather rope to which the scalps of his enemies were fixed with wire, each rope trailing far behind him as he walked. As he sat, he drew them in, coiling them about his feet and stroking the scalps as though they were pets. To his right, second in the arc, was Emish Ae of the Emperor's Children, a notorious reaver and architect of degeneracies. Emish Ae's skin was pallid and wrinkled, the mark of the neural mites with which he had infested himself on some trackless death world to ensure the constant agonizing stimulation of his nerves. He was armoured in a breastplate of dazzling polished silver, studded all down its length with barbed hooks and metal burrs of exquisite fineness and elegance, and he wore his tongue stitched from his mouth, drawn down and pinned over those spikes, so that he could toss his head and relish the sensation of the tender meat being torn. Third was the word-bearer, Drachmas, who placed in front of his seat a brass bowl of smouldering ash that was his personal talisman. This ash was made from the burning bones of Imperial Adeptus Astartes, whom he had defeated but who refused to turn their loyalties to the ruinous powers he served. They were worked so that they would burn forever in the bowl and never be consumed. Atop the left pauldron of Drachmas's ancient and dark red plate rode a tiny gargoyle, whose belly was all bright clockwork and engines, but whose limbs and head were demon flesh. The creature grasped one of the great steel horns on his helm and whispered passages from the works of Lorgar in a tiny, scratching voice. The fourth in the ark, sitting at Chengrul's right, was Crove of the Thousand Suns, who had arrived alone, declaring himself the envoy of several sorcerer lords to whom Chengrul had sent heralds. Crove was dressed in the baroque custom of his legion, his armour and cloak worked with lustrous blue and gold, adorned with rich azure surcoat, whose hem shimmered with all the colours the eye could describe and with the indescribable hues of the warp. In one arm he cradled a tall adamantine staff, inlaid with threads of psychoreactive crystal and topped with a great darkened sapphire. Chengrul's head bobbed in its little curved window, and he looked from one to the other, his displeasure unabated. He resolved to make it known from the first who was the master of masters here, and addressed the other legionaries with the following. "Resolve upon my words, my blood cousins and fellow champions of the legions. You attend here upon Chengrul, birthed a child of long-raised Olympia, and wrought a blood child of great Perturabo, mighty among all the Primarchs. Named Iron Warrior in the great crusade of old, and named traitor when our legion fathers rose up to make an eternal corpse of the one who named himself Emperor in punishment for his vanity and his faithlessness. Made outcast when our legion was forced from the ramparts of terror and made master on unconquerable Midringard, when my warsmith saluted my prowess before Perturabo's gates and in sight of my company. It is I who claim this world and make this fortress of it, and I who recovered these caged souls before you." For the lustrous stones were set at Chengrul's feet, flanked by two of Chengrul's most trusted Terminator guard. "And although I shall dispose of these stones to whichever of you offers the greatest tribute in exchange, you must acquit yourselves in another way." The grate of his voice from his speakers mixed with the creak of metal and the hiss of pistons as his tank shifted on its stout legs.
I am no beast, thrall, or petty hetman, such as think themselves grand for raising up a rabble in the Eye of Terror, or on some decaying colony world, he told them. And I shall treat with none who are not my peers. For your bids you shall present not only your material offerings, but an accounting. You shall tell on the honour of your legions of a feat of arms and generalship, showing yourself most deserving of this prize. And consider now the evidence of my good will and favour, for before you begin your bids, I shall furnish you with an account of myself, by which you shall know my power and my worth.
In this way, Chengrel of the Iron Warriors began his tale.
Accursed are the sons of Dorne, who call themselves the Imperial Fists. Accursed are the sons of Gilliman, who call themselves the Ultramarines. Do you recall the face of Dorne? His vanity, and his intransigence, his petulance, his worming sycophancy. Do you recall the face of Gilliman? His arrogance and his presumption, his treachery, his cowardice. What soothing balm it was to see those faces at the Iron Cage. Dorne's cries in the trenches. Gilliman's dismay when he saw what we had made of his weakling brother. These were memories I took care to harden against the passage of time and to return to over and again. By the day of my ascension to my own command, when I watched a cohort of Iron Warriors raise their fists above their heads and shout their loyalty to me, I knew my first endeavour would be to once again see the sign of the fist and the sign of the Omega brought low together. Hegoru, this was the world I chose for my purpose. Slow-boiling Hegoru, with its shifting lands of slick grey rock, and the rich red cauldron of its oceans under sulphur skies. I had passed close by there in the Crusade. And you, any of you, did your fleets take you into the galactic southwest? No answer. No matter. At Hagaru, we heard, the Imperial Fists had celebrated the world's compliance with a ring of great works around the polar coast. Towering hive cities thrusting high above the heat haze of the land, linked one to the next with bullet rails and laser nets that flickered in the cloudy dusks. The Imperial Fists had crowned Hegoru, so they said, given it a regal coronet to celebrate its ascension to our human Imperium. We laughed to hear that, until we saw that Perturabo did not laugh, but looked at the pigs through hooded eyes and then turned his back upon them. From then on, we only spoke of yellow-crowned Hegoru in soft and bitter tones. Much later, too long and strange a time of warp-faring for me to know the years, the name came to my ears again as I roamed that track of space, brooding upon how best the Crusade's work could be unworked again. The warp was thick with the babble of Imperial astropaths, and when my own seers plucked the connection between their minds, we found the hailing codes of the Ultramarines, the strutting, preening heirs of the strutting and preening Gilliman. They boasted of an Ultramarine's triumph, doubtless unearned. Bloodshed had come to Hegoru in the form of a reaving Xenos, whose nests the Ultramarines had purged. What water-blooded things the 13th had become, to boast of this as a mighty victory. But boast they did. And when I led my loyal Iron Warriors back to Hegoru, their words still burned in my mind. Their words burned, so we burned the cities to match them. We re-crowned Hegoru in the rich yellow of flame, not the spiritless yellow of the 7th banners. We showed the defenders of the dawn-built cities who was the more steeped in siegecraft. Our lance and battery strikes tore the atmosphere until it boiled, scrubbing whole flights of their attack craft out of the skies, forcing their defense silos to try to track us through superheated clouds and radiation static while we bombarded them with precision. 20 days we jousted with their cannons from orbit, the sum of the numbers of Gilliman's and Dawn's legions. And on the 21st, we took to our landers to bring the little mortals their doom with our own hands. I was not as you see me, not then. I strode to war in Terminator array, badged in adamantium and black and yellow. I strode with my assault pioneers in the first flight of storm torpedoes, spearing through the skin of Rogium Hive, whose voids had crumbled before us. The upper hive had been sloped to deflect such an entry, layered and honeycombed to rob a storm torp of its momentum and trap it in a maze of half-collapsed cells. But those we left behind in the Imperium are stupid, my brothers, and they forget. The defences had been quarried hollow, leached of their strength by complacent generations. Ah, the glorious clamour of a storm torpedo's passage into an enemy bastion. There are moments in a siege more satisfying, but few more exhilarating. Once we were in among them, they forgot any fortitude they had known and fled from us. I had vowed that I would spend my shells only in true combat, and so instead slew with my power fist, the raking spikes of my armour painting my arm in blood to the shoulder. The blood and dust from our bombardment made a red grey slurry on my fist, which stained the golden aquila from the temple spire when I crashed it in my claws.
Chengrel's head twitched and bobbed in its fluid as the memories of the slaughter excited him more and more.
What worth now the pride of Dawn? Had he made something that could stand against us? He had not. Rogium was our breach, and into it we poured. The Emperor's flocks were panic-blind, and only one of the neighbouring hives thought to destroy its bullet rail links in time. To reward them, my artisans built blast carriages that rode out along the rails faster than sound, wrecking themselves where the rails had been severed and flinging plasma charges into the flanks of Tolmir Hive. Along the other line to Baronvelt Hive went the Hive's own cars, wrapped in cunning armour, fashioned by my metalworkers and warpsmiths, filled with warriors I had hand-picked to present my greetings. Cold-armoured, cold-eyed siege teams, adept in crippling a hive's vital systems or wrecking its adamantium and carbon foam bones. And the fire to their frost, hot-blooded berserkers, brothers who had forsworn their loyalty to the throne of gold and pledged it to the throne of skulls. No one who has not built a fortress can truly understand what it is to destroy one. A fortress falls the way a warrior falls, and every fortress's death is unique. Every tyne in Hegera's coronet died its own death. Tolmir died like a warrior before an enemy's guns, its sides caved by the plasma charges like a breastplate breached by a bolt round. For 2 days it sagged in a death of agony, and sagged over the crater in its side, as a man might double over a death wound. And then the peak and shoulder fell in upon the foundations, crumbling in that obeisance to death that we have all seen on the battlefield. The pall from the collapse still shrouded its ruins as we took our leave from Hegera. Baronvelt was stung by our troop trains, like an unwitting scout stung by death world vermin. My warriors were the infection, the venom. The berserkers roared through its halls like a fever in the veins, wetting the toothed chains of their weapons so deeply that they may still drip with Baronvelt blood today. My own iron warriors were subtler poison, stopping the organs and nerves. They crippled the power and data lines, the air and water purifiers, the climate controllers, and left Baronvelt's corpse dark and still. Mazoga Hive perished like a trooper whose foot has kicked a mine. A seismic bombardment cracked its geothermal core, and the shockwave of magma that burst up through its foundations toppled the hive, lit up the night, and choked the sky. Dekashel Hive bled out, its populace streaming out into the hot gravel of the wasteland as we wounded the upper levels. Kailinga Hive died a coward's death, paralyzed by the sight of true war, torn between trying to evacuate itself, fight, or surrender. The indecision robbed it of sinew and made it prey for us. Dofil Hive, weakened the most by the Xenos purging, died a death worthy of respect, the death of a wounded veteran who will not allow his wounds to humble him. It ended in madness at Atagal Hive, with all the rest of Dawn's Cornet left behind us in ruin. My berserkers still rode their rage, as though their fury was a furnace, and the endless bodies they sighed through just fuel to stoke it. Some had drowned so deep in bloodlust that they chased fleeing refugees away into the wastes and could not be recalled. But the rest put the sacking of Duafel at their backs and lunged across the wastes. When they exhausted the fuel in their own transports, they pillaged the refugee columns for trucks or gravel crawlers. When they had burned out the engines of their new steeds, they tore them apart in pique and rushed on foot. They had run loose in bloody delirium through half of Atagal before we caught up and saw their handiwork. We found Khorne's sigil hacked into the rock-creep walls with chain blades, or scrawled in the blood slicks that ran in the roadways. We heard the guttural prayers they had set the Hive's address system to repeating beneath the squeals and cackles as the power of the name surpassed the fragile Vox circuit's tolerances. We heard them screaming the name of their god over the scream of Chainax biting bone. Now their brass-shod master's gaze fell on them, counting the skulls they had littered in their wake for him. And as Atagal Hive became a slaughtering pen, he made his favour known. Some berserkers seemed to be running through water, leaving ripples and wakes behind them. Others cast too many shadows, which reared and thrashed with a life of their own. The smoky breeze carried howls and snatches of shrieking laughter that came from no human throat. Gash marks and bloodstains began to scar the walls where there were none to make them. The demons of Khorne were making themselves manifest. In silence, my brothers and I left the charnel floor to the berserkers and climbed through the hive. We witnessed screeds etching themselves into its walls, blasphemies bursting from the vox horns, faces forming in the clouds beyond the window walls. The trees in the arboreta had turned blood red and sprouted thorns like fangs, and their boughs thrashed in time with the heart drums of the demons below them. Standing at the pinnacle of Atagal Hive, I proclaimed our task complete. We cast down the golden aquila that had spread its wings atop the final tine of Hagara's coronet, and in its place raised our own marker, a single upright girder decked in adamantium and yellow and black as our own armour was, splashed with blood from Khorne's killing house below. The hives of Hagara burned, the legacy of Dawn was trampled and cast down. The verminous imperials of Hagara perished. The labours of the children of Gilliman were in vain. And so I show to you the trophies of my victory.
Into the amphitheater clattered a procession of defilers, each bearing the wrecked remains of a golden imperial aquila high on its hull like a diadem.
The eagles from each spire tip fell into Hagara's sinking clouds, the prize from my finest conquest. Iron within, iron without.
The two Terminators guarding the bag of stones took up the Iron Warrior's mantra at Chengral's shout, and a moment later it began to issue from the speech horns of the Defilers themselves in counterpoint to their tread. The whole meeting square filled and rang with the noise. When the monstrous parade had passed, Chengrul declared the first day of the gathering to be over, and bade all his guests depart to muse upon his tale, and decide for themselves if they had any to match it. Then, satisfied that he had the measure of this meagre assembly, Chengrul returned to his citadel, where he withdrew his bloated head deep into his tank, and had his chamber shrouded in darkness. Emishai hurried away to his barbed and scarred cuttercraft. He craved raw sensation after so long with little but words for his senses to batten on. Crove was behind him on the trail to the landing camps, but made no effort to enter the shining pyramidal lander which hung over his ziggurat. Instead, he drew his feet up under him, hanging unsupported in the air, and a moment later, the ground beneath him creaked and erupted in a great thicket of thorn tendrils formed of a strange stuff that seemed at once metallic and gem-like. They enclosed him and hid him from view. Drachmas, the word-bearer, and Hodir, the Night Lord, went walking more slowly back through the ruins, their cadres filing behind them and studiously ignoring one another.
"How do you consider our host, then?" asked Drachmas, after an interval long enough for his little homunculus to have recited the 4082nd Epistle of Lorgar in its entirety.
"Old," Hodir replied thoughtfully. "Clever. Fortunate." He looked behind him. "Well guarded."
"Fortunate," Drachmas replied with equal care. "Fortunate indeed. And one whose fortunes will bear watching. Perhaps we are of one mind here." Hodir was generous enough to concede this with an inclining of his dark-helmed head.
"Well then," Drachmas went on, "we shall hear more of this convocation soon."
He did not bow or salute, but made a deliberate step away to show the conversation was at an end. Hodir did likewise, weaving his feet so as not to crush his ropes of scalps, and the two parted to return to their camps. 17 hours passed before a klaxon sounded from Chengrul's fortress, the blaring followed by a quartet of household serfs who scattered out through the ruins and to the landing pads with the message that the master would soon be ready for the new day's audience. Crove was the first to return, appearing from his nest of vines as it unravelled and striding alone to the meeting square to take his seat. After a few moments, footsteps sounded behind him, and over them came the voice of Drachmas's demon homunculus, droning through the opening stanzas of Meditations on Two Transcendencies. It was one of Lorgar's more pedestrian works, and the papery little monotone did nothing to capture what nuance it did have. Hodir took his seat, settling silently into the same position he had had for the previous audience. The addition of two silver armatures mounted on his armor's backpack, which now kept his scalp ropes suspended in a cat's cradle above his head, was the only sign he had moved at all. Emishai was the last to join them. He still wore his silver breastplate, although his tongue had been unpinned from it and rearranged on a different sequence of hooks. Across his shoulder was a mantle of glass links, deliberately crude in make, so that they grated against one another with a sound to put the teeth on edge. Maddening as the sound was to those around him, it clearly soothed Amish-Ai, whose amplified hearing craved input in this relative quiet. Chengrul broke through that quiet for them, his tank hook walking into the enclosure with a heavy tread and taking a position on his stone platform.
"I have granted you ample time to prepare yourselves," he boomed. "Now we shall see what you bring me in return. Look to your own accounts. Hodir, Night Lord, Master Hodir, son of the fallen Kurs, you shall speak first. Begin."
If Hodir took offence at the curt instruction, he gave no sign of it. Instead, he stood and walked towards Chengrul with something in his hand. Instantly, one of the Iron Warrior bodyguards came forth, something in a shape that might once have been an armoured space marine, but which was now a hunched and creaking thing. Its legs were fused together, and it moved on a rolling tank track that had replaced its feet. although this track was made of thick muscle, and its treads were bone claws. Its arms ended in bundles of gun barrels, and its face, sprouting directly from its neck between clusters of thick steel horns, was a leering mask made of tarnished ceramite. A meaty tongue flopped from the mask's mouth slit and tasted the air.
"I intend no violence to your master, and none to you," Hodair told it. "But since you are studying me for him, then examine this."
He held out the thing he was carrying, a triangle of white and yellow cloth, obviously cut from a larger piece, embroidered with a complex design. As the green-black tongue lapped the air near it, Hodair turned it over to show that it had been sewn back-to-back with a triangle of human skin.
"Skin only recently stripped," Hodair declared. "Can you sense that?"
The bodyguard, uncertain of its reply, swiveled on its squelching, clicking tread feet and looked up at Chengrel.
"Fresh to confirm that we do have him, and that he's still alive and healthy." "He was when I set out to visit you, anyhow. From there on, you must take us on faith." "You give me riddles," replied Chengrel, amid the thrum of his speakers. "Give me an offering and an accounting, or be sent back to tell your legion of my disappointment with their envoy."
Hodair did bristle at that, drawing himself up and letting the others see that his free hand had made a fist. But he kept his temper and turned, so he addressed both Chengrel and the other traitor marines.
"If I am to account something for my bid," he said pointedly,
not using Chengrel's word offering,
"then my account and my bid go together here."
He held up the sewn flap of skin and cloth again.
"I will explain what it is, how we came by it, and what it is worth to all of you."
Hodair of the Night Lords began his tale.
"The tattoo on this skin," declared Hodair, "is a navigator crest, the sign of the House of Drunai, a house of no particular glory. I had not heard of them before. The man who yielded us his skin told us his name. Vivier Drunai, a young man, but a skilled one. How skilled, you shall see. Vivier Drunai is not the bid, but he is a part of it. Now, there is a warp vortex northward of the Tenbine Drifts in the galactic northwest that pierces down through the galactic plain. It boiled there when the Crusade first mapped the borders of what they now call Obscurus, and it boils there still. The violence of the funnel current is fed by the storms radiating out from the eye below and northeast of it. Shipmasters, driven by haste or hubris, sometimes catch the edge of the tide and let it fling them towards Sibra Mundi. But it is a turbulent and dangerous passage. Its lower reaches, I am told, have never been charted, and who is to say if there is any end to it? Perhaps it plummets out of our galaxy and continues forever down into the gulfs. Drift too close into the funnel of the storm, and you will be dragged in and dragged apart. There is no surviving it. The vortex is not the prize, but it is a part of it. There is a place where the vortex bends through an angle from the push of a countertide, and there the storm's cohesion breaks. That is the jaw, where a storm whirl juts out like a greenskin's chin. It throws out blast fronts that are felt sectors away, vortices that spin for 100 light-years before they exhaust themselves. It makes storm-stitched patterns that wriggle and swim and fight to come to life. And it disgorges ships. The Melonious Reach in real space, out beyond the jaw, is a Hulk's graveyard, like few others. The storm drags ships from their courses and plunges them through who knows what depths, and the gravity well of Melonious's great blue star is where so many of them are dragged back again. A trail of wrecks, parsecs long, strung out and drifting. The ship's graveyard is not the prize, but it is a part of it.
The Imperium sits with their backs to it. They are so sure that this great ship's graveyard is a graveyard indeed, and no threat to them. They have built a fortress at the far end of the stream of wreckage. A magnificent thing, truth be told. Tier on tier of gun decks, lance mounts, deep gauge Auspex arrays. It trails free floating fortifications behind it. Communications boosters, munitions depots, shipyards and repair docks. Squadrons of warships fuss around it. The scale of the place has grown. They are colonising other moonlets nearby so the fortress crews can expand. Who knows? Perhaps Molianis might one day house a world's worth of colonists. The fortress is not the prize, but it is a part of it. The Imperials are sure that the stream of warp wreck emerging from the storm is broken beyond all chance of threat. Fitful patrols through the graveyard sweep the hawks with Auspex, and they mutter on the vox about quarantine checks, wrecks to be sterilised to gene stealers and ransacked. Beyond Morlianis, there are thickly infested orcish enclaves, and so the Imperium's attentions turn that way. The goal is to place an Imperial eye between the greenskins and the graveyard to make sure that no salvage can fall into the orcish hands and into their war machine. The Imperium's unguarded flank is not the prize, but a part of it. While he spoke, Hardea had been walking slowly to and fro beneath the windows in Chengral's tank hulk, while the Iron Warrior looked down at him with an expression intended to show benevolent indulgence. Now he faced the other bidders, again holding up his token of stitched skin and cloth. "We went raiding, my night lords and I, and in the greater Tembine drift, which stretches out across the northeastern quadrant like a shoulder blade. Ships striking out from the rich worlds of the Lesser Tembine Drift and pushing up through the unsettled layer between them can expect a long and tranquil voyage, coasting on the gentle outward pressure of the drift tide towards the far northern marches of the Ultima Segmentum. Such was the voyage our prey had in mind when they ignited their drives at Iseth. It was a supply convoy, heavy and slow, like fattened ket cows, plodding towards the reaches with material from the Mechanicus forges, fusion-formed alloys, tailored reactant blocks of plasma furnaces, biological stock, weapons, machines. We heard tell that the cargo was on its way to a string of new colonial hives. We had other intentions for it. You need not hear the details of how we struck and what we took. All of us knows the ways of these things. You can imagine the ambush and the boarding. We had three of the four ships by the time they reached the Issef jump zone. Plucked them, where the Imperial flotillas could not defend them. The convoy's lead ship was the Hymn of Phalanoid, and I marked her as my prey and my prize. We harried her with weapon bursts and vox taunts. We collected vox signals from the taking of the other craft, boosted them, and boomed them into the Hymn of Phalanoid, to let them hear how they died, those who fight the Night Lords. And when they did not surrender, we opened our own engines and bore down on them, skewering their hull with lance cuts and flying assault boats into the wounds, driving the crew into their suits, ready for the fighting. To a Night Lord, shipboard survival suits are a weapon in themselves. They blinker the sight with their little goggle insets or their narrow visors, so the prey's imagination fills their blocked peripheral vision with the monsters almost the equal of the monsters we are. They blur the hearing and fill it with scratches and garbling echoes to taunt tight-strung nerves. In those lucky enough to have vox circuits, they open themselves to our whispers and screams, should we find and break their transmission band, and we always, always do. They surround the limbs with heavy wrappings, burning movements, concentrating the sense in each prey's mind that they are cut off,
alone. Their companions now unfamiliar shapes on the other side of a visor. To a Night Lord, each of these things is like a slender stiletto, planted in the enemy before we even lay a hand on them. We breach some sections of the hymn to space. In others, we pump dusts and toxins into the airflows, or bled superheated gas from the plasma pipes to send firestorms through whole decks. Then walk through flames and chemical smoke to cut apart repair teams. We let word of us travel up the ship, always leaving one prey alive long enough to scream a warning into a speaking horn or flee to spread panic in person. We cut the lighting to hold decks, then left those decks to panic while we showed ourselves in compartments that had thought themselves uninvaded. Then we made those levels erupt in cries or fall silent forever, so that as we worked our way towards the bridge, we were fighting enemies tormented almost to madness by their own fear. This is our way, and if you, my fellows, have fought alongside us, then you will know it for yourselves. The only way this prey boat could think to fight back was to spite us of our prize and drag us into the immaterium to die with them. The ship began to shake around us, and we heard the alarms in the corridors and the prayers and weeping of those who knew what they meant. We had not wrecked the warp engines, not when there would be salvage to be had there, and the captain had given the order to breach. We had little time. We had broken through in a calm current, but soon the fear and the violence would echo, cohere, and turn in on us. Gellerfield systems are tenuous things, even on an undamaged craft. We had to move swiftly. Now we became true predators, dealing our quick butchery in place of slow terror. By the time we had scoured the crew decks and mustered at the base of the bridge tower, hot shadows were moving in the hymn of Philandi's warp wake, and as we brushed aside the last surviving crew, we could all feel the ship shudder and our thoughts twist as conscious force began to grip the Gellerfield and crush. There were none left living among the bridge crew by the time we reached them. Some had turned on the others. Fear? An attempt to mutiny and make for real space again? Warp phantoms, colouring their thoughts? No matter. But then we found that the captain had ceded control of the helm directly to the navigator's roost. Our steersman now was Vivier Drunai, and Drunai's order was to plunge the ship into that vortex that leads to the jewel, to be torn apart down to its adamantine bones and its plasma heart. And now the battle for the hymn, and for our own lives, began in earnest. Engineering servitors had welded the shutter doors to the final sanctum that held the captain's and navigator's eyries. The welds new enough to still glow in our infrared as we broke through. All the while, the vortex tides tore at the Gellerfield, like a butcher trying to flay a carcass with too blunt a knife. We could feel the hottest humours of the immaterium trying to boil into our thoughts. Three servitors were still there, sealed in their instruction to try and fight us. Two had their welding torches broken so that we could not commandeer them, and those two assaulted us with rivet drivers that scarred our armour with red-hot plugs of alloyed steel.
Hodair turned now, dipping one shoulder to show chips and scoring along one rim of his pauldron.
The third rushed at us with its torch still ignited, and Gaius, who aspired to lead my second claw and is boastful and eager, stepped forwards to show how he could cut it down. Then we heard the ultrasonic whine of its power pack and understood its purpose. It was overcharged and about to explode, and so Gaius shot it apart instead. In the captain's roost, all light was extinguished, as though he thought darkness might discomfort us. But we could see the smashed holo tank, the displays and consoles slagged by the servitors' torches. And we knew now how desperate we had made this man for him to mutilate his most sacred sanctum like this. He intended to take away all hope we had of breaking back through into the materium.
The captain himself was a dim shape behind the glass ache of his support cocoon. "Kill me now, if you must, traitors," he told us through the brass horns that clustered at the corners of the room. "Or let the warp take me, as it will take you, and let mine be the last loyal life you murder before you yourselves stand before him for your final immortal rebuke." With that he abandoned his threats and turned to prayers, which began to distort and be intertwined with more profane voices and more obscene words as warp influences trickled through the failing Gellerfield and began to alter the ship. But we realised that not all the screaming and the vox horns was the work of outside. No intruder from the warp would ever have cried out an imperial prayer or pled for the captain to show mercy and rescind his order. The voice was Vivier's, losing his mind to fear as he saw before him a fate that navigators must understand more keenly than any of us. The captain roared back, his voice shaking the horns, and even with only those mechanisms to give him speech rather than his own throat and tongue, even as the ship's gravity began to fail and light and sound to distort, we could hear the note of command in that voice that must have propelled his crew to take up arms against us, even in their terror. He shouted into the storm, telling the navigator to obey his captain and his emperor, lay down his life and soul, and deny the traitors to the last. Ulsh breached his cocoon and killed him then. Traitor has never been a label he has cared for. Now the guidance of the ship fell solely to Drenai, and I knew I would perish there. Navigator's commands must pass through the captain's own systems to be turned into intricate orders to the helm and crew, manipulating all the ship's systems in concert. What little direct control a navigator normally wields could not prepare him for this. We were as good as adrift, at the mercy of the vortex. So I thought, and so we all thought. But here is a lesson all Night Lords know. Terror transforms, and when Drenai thought himself lost, his terror ousted all conscious thought. He could not bring himself to abandon his soul to the warp. And so we rode the vortex down. How? I do not know how. I am no navigator nor a seer.
Man here, Hodea gave an inclination of his helm towards Crove, who returned the politeness in kind.
But I have seen warriors lent to genius by terror. Who amongst you has not seen it? Friend or enemy, terror fueling their prowess until it burns out entire. Navigator Drenai, who had steered us into a suicidal plunge against orders he had never wished to hear, now broke those orders and fought for his life against the storm. I remember moments of calm when the ship spun in its length so fast that the failing gravity was overwhelmed and we skidded and crashed against the walls. Uskel, our best demolisher, whose chain fists had cut our way from the bridge, was thrown into the dead captain's cocoon and vented his fury on the corpse and its systems. I remember the times when the vortex stripped the field away from us, and Drenai would shriek with panic to match the shrieking of the ship's hull. The shrieks, too, of whatever was grasping the hull of the ship. Cries of pain at contact with matter, perhaps, or of pleasure at having this new strange thing to play with. Perhaps they were born of no emotion any of us could understand. Perhaps some were even from survivors elsewhere on the ship, meeting the same fate from which Drenai was fleeing. At these times, the whole ship would lash back and forth like a crotalid's tail. I remember seeing the controls come to life again. The slag of the instrument panels began to writhe and rearrange itself, and a ghostly form of the hollow tank lit up over the wreck of the original. They lit up and showed us our own faces, and faces we had murdered, and faces we had fought with, and turned them into faces such as no human has ever worn. Electricity leapt between the crates in the instrument panels, the arcs rising up and taking on shapes I cannot describe, for they left only pocket holes in my memory. I remember that the sound of the engines, the great deep note that permeates every starship, never ceased. But it faltered and choked, and sometimes became a rhythmic sound like a living heartbeat, and sometimes like laughter. Uskel said he heard whispers in it, and when he tried to talk back to them, whatever those whispers told him in reply made him howl and swing his chain fists at empty space in front of him. The form of the ship began to soften and stretch around us. The captain's remains flowed and blended, the debris they lay in bubbled and shifted. Parts of it turned to emerald, parts to blood, and parts to light. The whole chamber stretched and narrowed, the deck under our feet suddenly darkened with corrosion and spat little puffs of dust. But as we looked back through the door, we saw the antechamber's walls turn to rib bone, gasp and rattle with some manner of life, then fossilise in seconds and become stone. Dancing lights cackled and chased each other around our heads. Gaius shot a bolt shell at one, and it turned from the chase and enveloped him for no more than a second. When it pitched him to the deck and departed, he thrashed on the floor and told us that it had dragged him into itself and toyed with him for 13 years. How long all this lasted, I do not know. I can tell you that 4 months passed by the sidereal calendar between us breaching the warp at Iseth and overhearing our first Imperial transmissions at Mollyans. But to most of us, that plummet down the vortex seemed to take only days. But we all know the fickleness of the warp and time. The other legionaries made small motions to indicate their assent. Finally, however, the vortex gave us up. After a final wrenching convulsion, the ship began a steady turning that we realised was adrift through real space. The deck and bulkhead ceased to change, leaving the chamber in its strange, angleless shape. Beyond it, we could see the stone ribs of the remade antechamber walls lit by dim starlight. Cautiously, we left the captain's sanctum to see what was left of our prize. The warp had remade the hymn of Philodyne beyond any recognition. Her whole form was drawn out and scattered as though something in the warp had pegged her out on a dissecting table. The hull had opened up to space, in some places looking torn open, in some places simply gone, as though melted or dissolved or stretched until it had parted. In some places it had even grown. A ridge of acrescence had pushed out of the hull along the port side that ate the shape of the bridge tower. Even growing vestigial windows, vanes and turrets had been shorn off or had sunk back into the surrounding hull to form strange, organic-looking shapes. The plasma engines had finally fallen silent, and we could see the tail of the ship cold, with no reactor heat or drive plume. In the plasteel of the decking was a set of neat footprints of bare feet the size of a child's, sunk into the metal the way they will sink into wet sand. They meandered into the bridge and ended there. We never learned what had made them. But when we turned our attention back the other way, we realised that Vivier Drenae yet lived. The seals and provisia systems of the navigator's roosts are intended to allow it to function while sealed off unto itself, so that any warp intrusion there might be checked before it can spread to the rest of the ship. Here they had worked in reverse, protecting him from the efforts of the warp to render the hymn down to nothing. As we walked back through the wreckage towards the roost, we could hear Drenae mewling on the vox, trying to hail the crew. His systems must have been wrecked by the transit, and his eyes out to the rest of the ship were blind. He did not know that we were the only ones he shared the hulk with now. He called for his captain and his retainers. He pleaded for status updates and sustenance. At times, he even seemed unsure whether the ship was still in the warp. I think his senses were still ringing from the storm in the jaw. I think he realised what company the storm had left him with when we began trying to break into the roost. The roost was an easy thing to see now. It had largely withstood the warp erosion, but the hull and decking around it had been reduced almost to lacework. We linked the vox and auto-sensor systems in our armour under the guidance of Hottish, our signal swift. These roosts are built with defences and wards, but not against the kind of attack we were mounting now, and not against invaders of our skill. Soon we had the control of the internal cogitators of the roost, cut off Drenae's vox link, and began to use the roost's more powerful systems to spy out our location. The sensors of our own armour had registered whip cracks of noise and flickers in our visors, which we dismissed as the after-effects of the turmoil from the voyage, but coupled into the navigator's bubble we were able to decipher what they were. We were listening to a cascade of military-strength Auspex pings, a stream of them, all tumbled over one another, some from mere light minutes away, others far older and fainter, sounded by ships prowling the other side of the system, the Mullianus system. With her brilliance born of terror and reflexes strung with the raw instinct to survive, Vivia Drenai found a skein of warp flow down through the vortex from the Tembine drift into the warp storm of the jaw. A needle's eye that leads into a blind and undefended flank of a prime Imperial military system. The Night Lords will ride on Mullianus again. And that is the prize. That is what I am empowered to offer you, Brother Chengrel. To take this crest as a token of alliance. What Drenai did once, he will do again. Send your finest warriors to ride back down the vortex and through the jaw with us, or honour us by leading the force yourself. Let us come upon the Imperial sentries whose eyes are all turned outwards and fall upon them. Become their red-eyed nightmares. If you simply wish to wound the Imperium, then wound it we shall. If you wish the fortresses of Mullianus as your prize, then claim them. My legion has no plans for them. If you wish a share of the plunder when the system is ours, then you shall return to your own fastness with great riches indeed. This is the account and the bid of the Night Lords. What say you?
Hodair finished his tale, standing directly before Chengal's tank, with his token upraised. The bodyguard's tongue had once again slipped out and twitched in the direction of the skin. The other three traitor legionnaires sat and studied the embroidery again, allowing their host to be the first one to speak. After a long silence, he did.
"My warsmith imparted good words to me," he said. "He told me there are none among us more cunning than a Night Lord with the opportunity of murder put before him. You understand why I recall those words now?"
Hodair made a gesture of assent.
"You had all the markings of an offering that would honour the Night Haunter's memory, Hodair,"
Chengrel went on.
"And perhaps, with my own tale to inspire you, you will be able to leave this place and do so."
The other three, experienced in reading hints of posture and movement through bulky armour, saw the anger rise in Hodair. They watched as he folded the token with exaggerated care and clipped it at his waist, and they saw how his hands clenched the instant he was not consciously controlling them. Chengrel, not seeing this or not caring, talked on.
"In exchange for your offering, Chengrel of the Iron Warriors gives his salute to your cunning and your audacity. But let my fortress and my account be an instruction to you. You must learn ambition, Hodair. A legionary with ambition befitting his status would have come to me not begging for alliance, but piling trophies before me. The heads of the naval captains and commissars, their caps nailed to their skulls. A barge hold full of material looted from their vessels. From navy vessels, mark you, Hodair. Warships. I would not have accepted an offering of your scroungings from a graveyard of hulks or some fat plodding supply convoy. So this is your account, chasing a handful of cargo haulers and being pulled into a storm you had no intention to enter. This is the tale that will have me think your warband great amongst the Night Lords. You belie your own pretensions to greatness, but still..."
And there was a slow burbling as Chengrel made what passed for a sigh.
"If the offerings of these others are more meagre still, then I may yet confer the prize upon you."
As the echoes of his voice died away, the enhanced hearing of the others, Amish Ari most of all, detected a small, rhythmic, metallic noise. It was the mechanized joints in Hodair's armour. They were sounding as he rocked almost imperceptibly back and forth, one hand now openly gripping the hilt of the power knife slung at his left hip.
"When the Night Lords return to Mullianus, said Hodir, in a voice plainly shaking with the strain of controlling his anger. I do not think we will enlist the forces of Master Chengrel as our allies. For a moment he seemed to have more to say, but instead he walked stiffly to his seat, placed himself upon it, and would say no more. Continues in part two. Follow the links in description or somewhere if they pop up on screen. Thanks for watching. Cheers.